Hello, beautiful people. Welcome to the Courage to Change a Recovery podcast. My name is Ashley Lowe Blassingame, and I am your host. Today, we have Steve Grant. On a December day in 2010, Steve Grant lost his 24-year-old son, Kelly, to an overdose. 5 years earlier, he lost his 21-year-old son, Christopher, in the same way. His only two boys gone. After a downward spiral of losing his marriage, his only two children, and dealing with the repercussions of such, Steve decided to take matters into his own hands and establish the Chris and Kelly's Hope Foundation to fight back. The foundation's mission is to provide financial support to programs that treat teens and young adults who struggle with substance abuse and addiction. The Chris and Kelly's Hope Foundation operates under the auspices of the Community Foundation of Greenville, but is committing to is committed to assisting worthwhile organizations nationwide. Steve's story has been featured in the Wall Street Journal and Clemson University's TigerIllustrated.com Letters from Dabo, section part 10. In addition to being the managing director of Mass Mutual in South Carolina, he is also a recent author with his book, Don't Forget Me, A Lifeline of Hope for Those Touched by Substance Abuse and Addiction. Whew, this episode was heavy. And it'll be heavy for you too, but the ability to stop. But Steve's willingness to find some sort of hope and some sort of courage to pull the courage out of this situation and create Chris and Kelly's Hope Foundation, help other families and to heal. Absolutely remarkable. As the mother of two boys, this was really, really hard for me to hear. But it was not a story of, utter defeat, utter failure, complete misery, desecration. It was a story of rising truly from the ashes of a situation that most of us cannot imagine. And, Steve was able to talk about that and, just to hear someone have this experience and be willing and able to come through it is beyond me. I hope I would have, the dignity and the poise and the willingness to do what he has done with his life if I were in the same situation. So really, really intense and beautiful story. And I hope you enjoy it and get as much out of it as I did. Please enjoy Steve Grant, episode 59. All right, guys, let's do this. Steve, I have some notes over here, but I doubt I'll need them. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I don't even remember where I came across your story, but I was telling my husband, I'm not a big crier, but I genuinely was so moved, and I may cry during this interview. So I apologize in advance
I might too.
Okay. So. Okay. Yeah. I have two little boys and I am a recovering alcoholic. And so is my husband. I'm actually a recovering heroin addict and
congratulations for recovery.
Thank you. Thank you. And my father, my father found me overdosed on May 17th of 2004. And I got a shot of Narcan that saved my life. And,
in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I didn't think Narcan was around.
Yeah. The ambulance, the paramedics happened to have it. And this was really before the onslaught of the epidemics.
Yeah.
So it was not quite as common. And, one of the things that really terrifies me these days is how common this is and how kids who you never would have thought before
you know, it used to be a junkie was a, you know, that was a, you had to do a lot to get to that point.
Yeah, you picture this person in an alley and he's destitute, you know, he doesn't know where to turn. And, you know, I'm shocked when I hear that you had Narcan in 2004, and I'm glad you're here and recovered. When my first son died in 2005 of a methadone and cocaine overdose in his bedroom, I didn't know anyone who lost a child, and I don't live under a rock. And I didn't know anyone though who's lost a child to a drug overdose. I didn't know anybody growing up who'd had a drug overdose. I've heard about a few lately. I didn't know that's how they did, but it wasn't common. It wasn't common in 2004. And even when Kelly died in 2010 of a heroin overdose, the only one I really knew was his brother.
Right.
So, but now it's, you know, I know someone who died yesterday. I know someone who died last week. So it's very common now. And it's unfortunate. I mean, we have to get rid of this critical pandemic, obviously. But one of the casualties of this, and there's several, but one of them is that the suicide rate's gone up. The drug overdose is going up. People are becoming relapsing, you know, because they're enclosed and there's nothing else to do. I've got, you know, they talk about the freshman 15. Yeah. I've got the quarantine 19.
I can't even look at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just like everything. Every time I'm home, I guess it's in my mouth.
Yeah. It's so true. Well, you have a remarkable story. As you mentioned, you lost both of your sons to overdoses, and you have dedicated your life to talking about it and speaking and making it worth something, which I absolutely can imagine is the only way to continue on, really. Can you give us a little bit of background on Steve? Where did you grow up and what was your upbringing like?
Sure. I was actually born in New York City. I have a twin brother, and my parents were, I think, 17 and 18 when my brother and I were born. It was a day and time where they said, "Mrs. Graham, we hear two heartbeats." This is when she's going into labor. So they had one bedroom prepared, and it was for two people. That ended up being, but we lived in New York for a little while. Then we moved to New Jersey. I had another brother and a younger sister after that. And, you know, as I wouldn't say a fairy tale upbringing, but it was, we were very middle class, but I didn't want for anything. And my parents were great people. And in Paramus, New Jersey was a great place to grow up. I had to leave it for the last 40 years to really kind of appreciate it. But it was a good place to grow up. And, you know, I was an athlete. I was captain of the baseball team, captain of the basketball team, those kind of things. I went to college on a small baseball scholarship and played college baseball. And, you know, then I've been in the financial services business for the last 40 years and done the same thing.
Yeah. And so you grew up in New Jersey, but you ended up in the South, right?
Ended up in South Carolina. So I went to school at Furman University, which is a small Southern Baptist school in Greenville, South Carolina. And from there, I stayed. And I went in the insurance business and have stayed in it ever since right here.
Is it that where you met your wife?
I met my first wife, the boy's mother, at Furman. She was a senior with me, and we got married right after we got out of school. And had Christopher, who, when we moved back to Greenville. Christopher was born in 1984, in May of 84. And Kelly was born in May of 86.
Okay. And what was your experience like with drinking drugs, like your exposure? Did you know anyone who was an alcoholic?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. My grandmother was an alcoholic. I mean, I didn't know, but my grandmother, which lovely, lovely lady, I loved her. She'd come to our house when I was growing up, and she would stay because she lived in New York and we lived in New Jersey. She would come and stay for 2 weeks, 3 weeks in the summertime or other times. And she always had this little glass of beer, and she poured it in this little glass all the time. And I didn't know what it was. I mean, I knew it was beer. I didn't know it was bad for you. I didn't drink it myself, of course, but she always had it. And it was always there. And my mother finally, when I was old enough to know, she said she was always, you know what, faced. Yeah. And I didn't seem like that to me. But then, of course, my mother had her take my grandmother. My mother when you read my book, my mother had a time when I was a freshman in college when she checked herself into a rehab. Now, my mother rarely ever drank. And it was really because my sister died in a car accident, and my mother started self-medicating with alcohol. And that's it's really kind of an interesting thing, because as part of my book, where I talk about some things that not a lot of people know about, and where I checked myself into a rehab for a couple of weeks because I found myself self-medicating after my son died, my first son died.
Yeah.
So it was very similar how the apple doesn't roll far from the tree.
Right.
But with that said, my mother's brother in Florida, who's still alive, was one of those guys that I don't know how they did it, but some doctor said, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. He stopped drinking. And to this day, he still doesn't drink. And that's years ago. Then I had his brother, my mother's other brother, died of alcohol-related death. Mother, grandmother died of cirrhosis of the liver. So there's a lot of alcohol on my side of the family. And there's a lot on my ex-wife's side of the family. My ex-wife's side of the family is more of a social drinker. You know, it's a rite of passage sort of stuff. You know, the cocktail at six kind of crowd.
Right.
But it's very consistent. Cocktails.
Right.
And cocktails is probably plural. So.
Right. And tell me about the car accident.
My sister's?
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of changed my parents' lives. I was home from school that summer, and she and her boyfriend I think they won a contest or something, and they won some money. And they say they're going to drive to the New Jersey shore. We were in northern New Jersey, and they had a two-hour drive to some kind of beach location. Well, they left, and my parents told them not to go, but they did. And I think what happened, he fell asleep. They hit a guardrail, and they both were killed. And the next morning, my mother got a call and said, your sister's been in an accident, and you better get to the hospital 2 hours away. So I remember driving my parents down there, only to realize that when we got there, she had probably died when we were an hour into the trip. So then I identified my sister, and it changed the course of my parents' life, frankly.
So what's interesting about your comment is that you talk about it with regard to it changing the course of your parents' life. But what about you?
Well, the whole process, I'm very much still the same person I always have been. I'm a giving person. I do anything for anyone. And I always say, listen, I'm a good guy, but don't mess with my wife and don't mess with my kids. Yeah. And so that's how I approach things. When I was taking Christopher to his first rehab, he said, Dad, I know what you're like. Don't bother that guy I got liquor from at 14 years old. He's been conditioned. He's got a family. I said, okay, I'm not going to bother him, Christopher. I mean, I did eventually, but I didn't that night, certainly. But, that's how I am. That's how I'm wired. So after my second son died, I really had no intention of starting something like Chris and Kelly's Hope Foundation. It was the furthest thing from my mind. So it was Christopher dies in 5 years. I went through a divorce that I didn't want to go through 30 days before Christopher died. So there was a double whammy there for a 25-year marriage. And that's another casualty of this issue. And although I'm remarried, I married a great girl who had never been married, never had kids. So, we don't have any children to worry about. But some of that I regret. Some of it is positive. She feels like she has two kids, though, if you were to ask her. Mm. Which isn't really fair for her. But I'm not sure where I was going with that.
Well, tell me a little bit about. So you had two sons, and you talked about Christopher's first rehab. Like, you had the two kids, and when was the first time you saw any signs of anything?
Christopher, I was talking about the foundation, but we'll come back to that. You know, that's interesting. I was starting to see some things that going on in our house and with his behavior, and I was reading a book one day downstairs, and it really wasn't bothering me any of these things. I grew up, you asked my experience. I didn't drink until I was probably a late teens, any kind of beer or anything like that. Never smoked marijuana until I got to college and did it infrequently. So I'm not a wallflower, but at the same time, so I know, and you kind of, I hate to say this, but whenever I talk to someone, I always pause when I say, my son's a normal person. But what is a normal person? Well, he drinks a little bit with his friends. And he has a little marijuana here and there. But, you know, parents, when they ask me, and I had three yesterday, you know, I always say that, you know there's something wrong when your son or daughter's life is being controlled by something other than what it should be controlled by. And for Christopher, I was sitting in my den one night and I was reading, and he came downstairs in his pajamas, good looking kid, 6 foot, beautiful. And he says, Dad, I don't want to be a F up. And he said the word, you know, we didn't promote cursing, but that's what he said. And I said, well, why do you say you need to be you're an F up, you know? But he couldn't tell me. He just kept saying that. And of course it bothered me, but he couldn't tell me why. And I had started years before, I helped start the suicide crisis hotline in Greenville. So, and I went through the training to listen to somebody on the phone who's thinking about taking their life. And it was very good training. I did it one night and stopped because I didn't want to go home and wonder what happened to somebody. But it was very good training to hear someone sometimes who, you know, they're saying something, but you don't understand exactly what they mean by it. So we kind of left that night like it was, you know. And about 2 weeks later, Christopher comes downstairs, same scenario. I was reading a book. He says, Dad, you're my only friend in this life. And I said, oops, you know, myself, I said, okay, here we go. And I said, Chris, you know, I said, I'm very flattered. And I said, but when I was 15 years old, and, you know, I wasn't the only freshman on the soccer team. I wasn't the only freshman on the basketball team. I didn't have all these girls calling me up and all these things you can be doing. And for me to be your best friend, I'm very flattered. But I said, that I shouldn't be your best friend. My dad's my best friend today, but he fell down the rung on that when I was 14 and 15 years old. So that told me he was crying out for something. So the next day, actually, I called a pediatrician friend of mine, and I knew about a psychiatrist in town who was very effective with adolescents. And I said to my doctor friend, hey, I'd like to get Christopher to see Dr. So-and-so. Something's going on, and I'm not exactly sure what it is. Okay. Now, I had found some beer cans underneath some sofas, a liquor bottle here, one maybe thrown in the backyard, one in the garbage can. You know, I was starting to see these subtle things going on. And not that they didn't bother me, but they were infrequent. But I by the grace of God, this psychiatrist actually saw me the next day on his lunch. And he's very hard to see. And he was very nice, and he came out of the room after talking to my son, and he just said, Steve, I can't tell you a lot because it's between Christopher and I, actually, but I'll just tell you that his life is being controlled by marijuana and alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, and I went, oh, you know, okay. So that's how it started. And 5 rehabs later, 5 boarding school, 5 different high schools after going to the same one for 10 years or same school system for 10 years, only to get your GED. And it was just, every step was just difficult.
When he would go to treatment, what would happen after? Like, how long was the effect? Did he want to stay sober? What was that experience like as a parent?
You know, going through it the first time, I was a little naive. When I was getting ready to do my rudimentary intervention with Christopher and choosing the night, and I remember how it happened vividly. You know, Christopher, you're going to a rehab facility in Tennessee for 90 days as soon as they call us. All right. He had got kicked out of his high school that he loved, and he was in a public school. And I told them, one of these days, I'm going to come get you. Well, the day came, and we went. And Christopher, you know, he didn't fight me on it. You know, I hear people say, don't stop the car, don't get out to do anything, just run. You know, he respected me. He was obedient, but his life was being controlled by alcohol and drugs. And he got there, and I still have the letters, and a lot of the letters are in my book. The first letter was, you son of a blah, blah, blah. You sent me here with a bunch of blah, 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 intravenous drug users, rednecks. I don't have the problems these guys have. You know, sometimes I wish I could go back to those guys and say, are you still alive? Because Christopher's not, you know, but that's what he said. I mean, but the letters got better. And I always tell people that go to treatment, it's almost like your brain changes. And I'm on the board of the Medical University of South Carolina down in Charleston, where it's the Center for Drug and Alcohol Programs, which is about 15 of them around the country, where these people study the brain and say, this is how it changes. And sure enough, these letters were, Dad, you know, I know I've got to stop drinking, but you know, I really like that marijuana, and all I do is a little weed.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
In fact, the book was going to, and that, you hear that a lot now because of the legalization of marijuana, and kids are using it, and they say, all I do is a little weed. Well, for most people, for a lot of people, that's not the worst thing, but for some, it's going to be a bad thing, and it'll catch you. And man, he just loved marijuana, so he was starting to negotiate with me that arrival home. So 90 days came by, and hey, this is our son again, you know,
right.
this is our son again,
right.
But you know, we had all these ground rules set, and then bingo, they tell you, well, you better prepare for relapse. And I say, what do you mean prepare for relapse? I said, this is 90 days. We're done. We're going to go back to be on the basketball team, on the soccer team.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our life's going to go back in place. And you know, it didn't, it was for a little while, you know, but these kids, they have a mark on their back. And it is very tough to tell a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old, I wouldn't have heard it, you know. It's like someone would have said, Steve, we don't want you playing baseball ever again. You know, I'd have been, what? You know, I would have rebelled. Well, you know, he's hearing for 90 days, you can't do drugs and alcohol the rest of your life.
Right.
To a 14 or 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Me naively thought that would work. You know, but obviously it didn't. And so you planned for relapse. And all right, we did have a plan. And he actually went and lived with my parents, who live an hour and a half from here in South Carolina. I called my parents and said, would you mind having Christopher? Because he, you know how they say you can't go back to your old playground, you know,
right, play things. Stuff. Yep.
Yeah. So he's there. He's on the basketball team at this really it's a town that segregation still is kind of not a spoken term, but it wasn't long before he'd start using it again. And, you know, and then we were back, and that caused issues too. So it was a struggle.
How did this affect your marriage?
It was very stressful, you know, obviously having another son who with my parents even being an hour and a half away, but being much older, obviously, than Christopher. You know, they had their children ready, and they weren't expecting the grandchildren to come live with them, especially one that's as active as Christopher could be. And so they started dealing with things they really never dealt with from their own kids growing up, because we were pretty model children, actually. So I think we behaved and we understood what we were supposed to do and not supposed to do. But Christopher got dragged back into that again. So I'm driving back hour and a half every day for 4 days. I told my parents, I'm coming down. I'll leave you money. Take care of Christopher. I'm going to come down and watch him, because he was already starting to, you know, to kind of deviate from the plan, his own plan that he'd learned for 90 days, and now their plan. So he was starting. So, of course, I'm forming this alienation with my wife. We had already started to be, we were already, before that, having a difference of opinion on how to treat Christopher. You know, one of the things I talk to parents all the time, and typically they're not aligned. And that doesn't mean you're going to have an addicted child if you're not aligned. That just means that it helps, you know, it doesn't help the situation. But Mary wanted me to do it one way, and I wanted to do it another. So when I went on this thing about we got to take back our family, we got to, he's controlling it, we've got to send him to rehab. You know, I remember going to rehab, driving with Mary. We were already separated. Okay. Yeah. So we're driving to rehab, and we get out, and we leave them there. They talk to us about what's going to happen and things like that. And we're driving off, and we're going down the hill. And most of these rehabs, as you know, they're in the middle of nowhere. You know, I mean, this was outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, and people didn't even know where this was that lived in Knoxville. So we're driving off their property, and she is hitting me on the shoulder, saying, "Go back and get our son." Because I was crying, because he was leaving a 14-year-old. Go back and get our son. And this was the first time she ever showed any emotion about this. And I said, I am not going back. I am not. And I kept going, you know, but I never forget that. Because I really kind of made most of the decisions that involved this. But it got to be very, very stressful. And eventually, Mary, who loved her boys, you know, she was too much stress. She wanted out. It was, as you know, it controls everything. It started to control my finances. We had legal issues, tax issues, people throwing rocks through our window, people breaking our windows of our parked cars. You know, we, Christopher started owing people money. You know how those people get. And so we dealt with a lot of that stuff. And it was too stressful.
Why did you think that after 90 days that he would be recovered? Like, did you spend time learning about the brain? What was the educational piece? How did you think that, where did you get the information or the idea that he was going to be cured?
I guess that's just the general way. I'm fairly positive.
Okay.
So I didn't read any, I read a lot of things. And what I read was what exactly happened, other than I don't think Christopher got anybody pregnant, although he was very active. But, you know, I heard that I was going to have marital problems. I heard that I was going to have legal problems. I heard I was going to go bankrupt, maybe. I heard this. You know, we'll check the boxes, okay? And I said to myself, I remember reading and saying, well, this ain't going to happen to me. This ain't happened to me. We're going to knock this thing out, you know? And so no one counseled me on that. Even the psychiatrist who I love to this day, who was Kelly's psychiatrist, who's my psychiatrist, even the guy I love today, I mentioned him in the book, he handed me these three Xerox pieces of paper that had names of rehab facilities on it. Five, six, eight rehab facilities. And I still have it. And I became an educated idiot on rehab facilities. And then you got to worry about, well, does the insurance company pay for it? Who pays for it? How much do they pay for it? And all those kind of things. So since, you know, it was a process and it took a toll, but I took care of most of it.
Right, right. And so he continues on his path. And what's going on for Kelly, your other son?
Kelly is getting good grades. Like I said, he's the normal kid. He's not very athletic, totally opposite, but tried real hard. And it was fun to watch. He didn't want to be an athlete, but when he went out there and did it, he did. He wanted to be a drummer, and he eventually signed a record deal when he was down at the College of Charleston. With a record company before he died. But he was a gifted drummer, and I never put my arms around music. I could put my arms around basketball and baseball and this kind of thing, but I never could figure out music with him. So it was almost to a point where it got to be Kelly was Mary's son and Christopher was my son. And especially when I started going down places and visiting him and staying overnight with Christopher. So Kelly never lost his love for me, and I never lost my love for Kelly, certainly. But it was sort of like I kind of checked out. And in my book, I even checked out as a husband when we had children, because I didn't realize until later on down the road, way too long down the road, that a child, when they're born, is a welcome addition to an already existing family, where I thought that my family started when I had Christopher. And I remember telling my wife in the driveway that we've committed an unselfish act, and now we've got to put all our energy in our son.
And what do you think now? What's your belief now?
Well, no, now I believe that I think that marriage had to be solid, and I would put my kids before my wife, okay, very subtly, not overtly, but very subtly. And I think that was one of those things that pulled her apart from me, pulled her apart from our sons. There's a lot of things that go into that, but I remember those some moments more than others, and I remember that moment particularly, and I remembered it. I was reminded of it or told it actually when I went to a parenting class. But the boys were already in trouble, not Kelly, but Christian was already in trouble, and I'm sitting in a room with Kat, with my ex, and she finally got me to go to this class. Well, it was 10 Mondays in a row or something like that, and that's why I didn't want to do it. I was coaching the kids. It was going to be a commitment, and I really didn't want to do it. Well, it was great, but all the people in there with the other couples, well, they either had a bun in the oven or they just had a baby. You know, here I am with teenagers. You know, I'm learning this thing, and this couple says, "Well, your children are a welcome addition to an already existing family." And I went, "Holy crow!" And I remember apologizing to my wife out by her car after it was over. Really apologizing to her. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I said, Mary, I'll tell you the truth. I said, today was an aha moment, because I've never thought of us as a family until we had Christopher. I didn't think of you and me as a family.
Right. Right. So that's very different.
The order changed. And then when Kelly came, well, my wife went down to the fourth in the she was third in the peg. So, and it wasn't overtly, it was just subtly, and it was the way it was.
Yeah. I always joke about how the dog eats before I do, you know, like everybody and the fish, you know, everybody gets fed and it's, you know, and it's super hard without even, you know, without even the struggles you guys had to put that relationship first when you have when you have little kids and then when you have kids who are in trouble. I mean, that's all you could possibly think about. And I remember my parents talking about, you know, so I was born in 86 and
so is Kelly.
Right. And so I was the straight A student. I was head of every, you know, community service, you know, all the stuff. I was not the kid you would have banked on having these problems as looking from my parents' perspective. And, you know, I remember them talking about how they disagreed on when I should go to treatment. And in the time between when the one parent who was holding back for me to go to treatment and the time I actually went, I was kidnapped and I was, and then I was arrested and it almost blew apart my parents' marriage. And at the time, you know, even after treatment or in my early 20s, I did not understand what that would mean for a marriage, what that would look like. But I mean, I've had situations, I have a 3-year-old twin boys and,
I'm a twin.
I know. I love it. I love it. They're fraternal twin boys. And, and they, you know, we've had situations where, you know, is the fever too high? Do we go to the hospital or, you know, do we do an ice bath? Do we do Motrin? We're at each other's throats about, you know, whether or not what to do about a fever. Right. And that's just a fever. That's not a life-threatening situation. But so I can't even imagine, you know, when I look back on it, what that experience is like. And I remember my parents too, they thought that I was going to be, you know, cured or that I would, I don't know. And I went to lots of treatments too. And each one, you know, why couldn't I get it? I was such, you know, I'm a smart person. Why couldn't I get it? And it took so much education for them to understand how to support me, but that was not a priority at a lot of the places, which, you know, looking back, I think is so important for the family to have a really, really in-depth, both emotional, spiritual, and physiological medical knowledge of what we're dealing with, because, you know, we aren't the same person we're not the same child that you gave birth to. We become someone different. And I remember my dad saying, you know, I don't know who this person, I don't know who you are. I don't know who's inhabiting this body of my child because this is not my child. And that is really what happens to us.
Well, Ashley, you know, it's funny you say that. One of the aha moments with Christopher, when he was really something else and he was really causing trouble. He was almost getting physical with his mother, you know, and someone said, you know, you got to take your family back, Steve. So literally we came home from that session, just my wife and I, and he was in the garage and Christopher rarely ever cried. And I really did either, but he looked at it. He would say I was his best friend and I probably was. And he was always honest with me to a point. And then the honesty came a little bit harder, but I was in the garage and I said to him, just like your dad told you, I said, Christopher, I don't know who you are anymore, you know? And he just said, what do you mean by that, Dad? I said, I don't know who you are anymore. You're not the Christopher I know, and I know you could be. And he started crying and he was very offended by that. And I was kind of happy he was offended by it.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. It means there's something
there. He was shocked that I said it.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely remember feeling like I was possessed by something. And I really did feel like, you know, I don't mean to sound, you know, spooky or whatever, but I felt like there was a demon that had a hold of my person and that and that the things that I did and said and felt were not who I was at my core, but they were the only thing that was available to come out. And it was, you know, and heroin and opiates allowed, on the one hand, they created it. And on the other hand, they allowed me to escape from those feelings and come down from what felt like a possession really often and just kind of numb. When did you know that your son was using opiates, was using heroin?
Kelly was very different. And he had gone to, he was going to school and college in Birmingham. And then when his brother died, I made a mistake and I sent him back home the day after Christopher died. Let's get back to our lives. You know, all this. I'm going back to my life. You're going back to your life. You know, it wasn't that we knew Christopher was going to die, but we knew there was a chance that he was going to die because we had done everything we could do.
How old was he when Christopher died?
Christopher was 21. Kelly was 19. Kelly was 24 when he died. When he was 19 when Christopher died. And he was a freshman in college. And so when he came home for his funeral, I just said, look, we're going to go back, you know, because it's not that I wanted Christopher to die. Certainly I didn't. But there was this expectation. I sometimes talk to ladies who say, I have a black dress in my closet waiting for that phone call. Okay. Maybe your mom had a black dress in her closet at some point with the expectation that she's going to get this phone call.
I mean, they talk about my parents always talked about how, you know, for years it was every time the phone rang, their heart dropped. And my dad said, he said, you know, when I had the intervention and the people came to take me away and put me in the treatment when I was a teenager, my dad said that it was the first, he was so relieved, even though I was horrible to him and them when it happened, he was so relieved. It was the first day that he didn't worry that I was going to die that day.
Yeah, you know, that's right. I talk in the book about the time Christopher got arrested. He was in jail for 28 days. About 28 days, it just killed me every day to go down there and talk to him through plexiglass for an hour, okay? And it's hard to talk to someone every day for 30 days through plexiglass about something.
Yeah.
But I did it every day, and it about killed me to do that. But I knew at night where he was.
Yeah, that's, you know, what my parents would say.
He wasn't leaving jail, so I could sleep at least during the night. I had other things to worry about, but like what's going to happen when he leaves, but at least I was sleeping and didn't know. But you're right. We used to, I remember being curled up in bed with my wife, and we'd be praying that when is he going to come home? Where is he? Because we don't know where he is. This is, again, before cell phones were really, really, you know, everybody had one. That wasn't the way it was with for him. So back to Kelly, you know, Kelly, he came back. He finally said, Dad, I want to come back to Greenville. So I was, you know, I was kind of testing his emotions. And he came back here and he went to a school for a little while here in town. And then he just transferred to the College of Charleston. And down there, he met a friend who wanted to start a band. And they went to high school. They went to grade school together. I knew his family very well, knew him very well. And they started a band and they were actually rather successful. They went to this thing, South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And that's where we really found out about this. They came back from South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And Kelly, it was like in March. Kelly had come home and, you know, there were five guys driving in a van together, pulling all their instruments, not staying overnight because they couldn't afford anywhere, barely could eat because they couldn't afford to eat, right? Meanwhile, they're at South by Southwest, and I didn't realize that being invited to that is pretty good. So I never heard about it till they were going. And now I understand it's a big deal. But he comes back, and they drive through the night, okay? Well, Kelly has already started his situation. He fast-tracked from whatever you start heroin with to intravenous use. Interesting, his brother never did anything intravenously to my knowledge or to his friend's knowledge. Kelly was afraid of his shadow. And for me to think about him putting a needle in his arm, it just blows my mind to this day. But anyway, he fast-tracked to it. And I guess that is the appeal of that. And his friends that helped him do it, nobody knew about it other than a few people. And the girl that sort of supplied it. Well, he had an overdose that night that he came back from South by Southwest in March of 2010. And I didn't know about it. Nobody really knew about it. His friends called the emergency room. The girl called the emergency room. The emergency room picked him up in this parking lot by himself, took him there. And unfortunately, this is one of my biggest complaints. Here's a 23-year-old maybe at the time, yes, leaving the hospital. He's an adult, right? So he gets a little slap on the rear end of the back and says, hey, you could have killed yourself. You know, we saved you. Okay. And then just, he just walks out of there, right? And so I don't know anything about this. He doesn't really tell anybody about this. And a couple of months later, I get a bill from the emergency room, right? So they don't want to tell you this because it's private, but meanwhile, they want to send you the bill because you're the responsible party, right? It's just like college.
Classic.
It's just like college grades these days.
Right, right.
You know, you're paying the tuition, but the kid gets the grades.
Mm-hmm.
So I never could understand it. But now, so I get this bill, and it's for an emergency room visit. It's Kelly. I call Kelly up. I say, Kelly, hey, I just got this bill from Roper Hospital in Charleston for an emergency room visit. I don't know anything about this. And why didn't you use your insurance card and all this kind of stuff? Oh, Dad, you remember when we came back from South by Southwest? I said, oh, yeah, I remember. He said, I was exhausted. And I passed out, and my friends panicked, and my wallet was left in the car, and they took me to the hospital. Plausible? Yes. Okay? Because I knew, yeah, very possible. And Charleston, it's 100 degrees all the time. So, he came out, but it was a heroin overdose. And I did not realize that until one of his band members, his closest friend who didn't know it, called me one day and said, Mr. Grant, he called me in June. I remember exactly where I was. It was a morning. And he said, that was not a passing out. That was a heroin overdose. And I thought, holy crow, I'm going through this again. You know, I mean, my world was just rocked again. And I got in the car and I went down there to get him. And, I took him home and we drug tested him every other day. And he was off heroin for most of this, for that summer. Now, he might have been smoking marijuana. He might have been taking his Ativan prescription, but he wasn't using heroin. And he went back, and we had this deal when he went back to college in Charleston that if he – we had formed an agreement with the band. If he used, then he was going to rehab. And Kelly agreed. Okay? So here he goes back, and sure enough, after about 30 days, they call us, hey, we think Kelly's using heroin again. So I go down and get him again. But he didn't want to go to rehab because the band was the only thing in his life. He didn't really. He was 10 points away from graduating. You know, I'm talking about you got to get your degree, Kelly. You can be a rock star after you get your degree. Okay, so that was my big mission. And fortunately, the College of Charleston researched his transcript after he died. He got his diploma posthumously. Which was very, very nice. They did the ceremony down there. It was very, very nice. It's a goal after he died. That's another story in itself. But when we took him home, because the band kind of backed off on him, I lost my leverage that the band was not going to take you back unless you go to rehab. That was out. So I really had no leverage anymore. So he comes back. I'm not going to use that. I'm not going to use. And we're drug testing him again. And sure enough, he starts renting this house. Very close to me. We talk all the time. We're watching Mad Men on Saturday together, the whole nine yards. We're very close. I was close to both my boys. But one Sunday night, I couldn't get him. Couldn't get him on the phone. So it was very strange. I was dating a girl at the time. And I said, it's very odd that I can't get Kelly on the phone on Sunday. And also, when I text him, he usually calls me right back. So I was concerned. So I drove to his house, which was a few miles away. So his car was in the driveway, unfortunately. His car was in the driveway, which made me scared. Then I got to the door. It was deadbolted from the inside. So I knew something was wrong. I knew he was in there. And, I don't think he was sleeping. And, of course, I find a brick in the yard, and I break the window of the door, and I go in through. I get the deadbolt lock and go looking around for him in the house. It wasn't that big, but there he is on the kitchen floor. With a needle in his arm, and obviously he had died, and vomit coming out of his mouth, and phone was on the other side of the room. But whatever he took, somebody had sent him marijuana from Charleston, a girl, and actually he kept it there for quite some time because the coroner said he had one needle mark in his body when he died, which is not the sign of an intravenous drug user or a consistent one. So here he was with, and the night before he died, he called his close friend, this girl that's always been in his life. They were just friends. and Anna. And Anna, she said, Anna, do you have any Suboxone? I'm feeling a little jonesy tonight, right? So if he had called me and said, Dad, I'm feeling a little jonesy. Can I have some? I don't know what jonesy really is. I do now. But if he had said Suboxone, I knew what Suboxone was by this time. I was become an educated idiot on everything. So I knew what Suboxone was. And if he had said that to me, I said, yeah, I know what's going on, Kelly. We'll get you some Suboxone. Well, she said, I don't know what that is. She had no idea Kelly was addicted to heroin. So she said, I don't know what that is, Kelly. So literally, you know, he used it and it pretty much went straight to his heart. And what happens when you start using heroin, as you know, maybe after a period of time that you don't use it, you usually don't go back to where you started. You go back to where you ended, you know? And he went back to where he ended, and that was it. And it's very tragic and a very gruesome scene. His brother, when I found his brother dead in our house, he was looked like he was sleeping. And, you know, looked like he was just going to wake up any second. Kelly's was a little nastier, obviously.
So, Steve, you found both of your boys?
Yes. Yeah.
What does that do to somebody?
It's you know, people always say, you know, do you ever have problems? The times I have problems is the times I think about where Kelly was on that floor or how he looked. I think about that sometimes, and sometimes it really gets on my mind, and I dwell on I dream about my kids often, and it's interesting. My dreams are always about when they were little. They're not about when they were big. They're never big in my dreams. They were always little. And they are always. I always realize at the end of it when I wake up, they were clean, they were healthy, you know, they weren't using drugs. You know, it was the light. And it's funny how I had just dreams of that time versus the other time. And I really mean that. I really mean that. But it, Kelly's death was that really took me by surprise. It was a real gut punch, and it was a gut punch for a lot of people because no one knew it. No one knew. In fact, I didn't share till really close to the end with my ex-wife because we were already divorced and everything like that. And unfortunately, well, I'm not going to worry about that. Okay.
Did you call her to tell her?
Yes. So my wife is a gifted linguist, and she's fluent in three languages. So she's a university professor, and so she was in Spain actually when Christopher died. So we called. I had someone call her over there that knew where she was, and that got her home for that. So we came. She got home for his funeral, and I was able to call Mary that night and get her there when Kelly had died. So yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. They both weren't communicating very well with their mother at the time of their death, which I feel badly about. But I didn't create that.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to me about what recovery has been like for you after this experience, and you know a little bit about what you would have done differently and what you would have done the same.
This question comes up a lot, and I did a radio show the other day, and with someone from Columbia, South Carolina, and they asked me basically the same question, and I told them that I have very few regrets about how I handled it because I handled it how I knew to handle it. I didn't seek a lot of advice, and it wasn't because I was ashamed. A lot of parents don't want to talk about their kid abusing drugs and alcohol. It's a very very mom thing.
Yeah.
So me, it wasn't. Not that I told the world, but when Chris was in Tennessee. While my ex-wife was saying he was in boarding school, I was saying, no, he's in rehab.
Right. My mom did the same thing.
Yeah, he's not boarding school. Christopher was telling people he was in boarding school. You know? Right. And one time he came home, he was in church with us. One of the most consistent things in our life, we always went to church on Sunday. Didn't matter how bad Christopher was, how bad Kelly was. Kelly was never bad. You know, his was 8 months. Chris was 8 years. But he would always go to church with us. He knew that we were going. And a lot of it, that was my wife, which I'm glad she did. But I remember he was home visiting, and everybody was sort of wondering where Christopher was. You know, some knew he was in rehab, some knew he was in a boarding school. And one of my close friends came up to him and said, hey, Chris, how you doing? He said, oh, I'm doing great. And Christopher looked great. He looked great, you know. And he said, I was talking to somebody, but I was listening to their conversation. And he said, John said, hey, Chris, where you been? What are you doing? You know, you playing basketball, you playing soccer. He said, no, I'm actually in rehab. And the guy said, like for a knee, for a back. And the guy said, Chris right away said, no, no, Mr. Wofford, I'm there for alcohol and marijuana. And I was proud of him. I was proud. He knew why he was there, you know, and he'd gotten it. So that's part of it. So when you talk about guilt, I don't have a lot of guilt because I left it on the field in the way I knew. I spent a lot of money, boarding school, 5 high schools, you know, rehab facilities, you know, and your parents will tell you there's a lot of soft costs, obviously, that go into this too, besides the hard costs. And then there's the cost of how many years sleep I've lost.
Oh, yeah.
Those kind of things. But from a guilt standpoint, like I talk to parents and they feel guilty about what happened. I think guilt sometimes or grief, I don't grieve a lot, and maybe I should do it more, but I don't. There's one component of my grief that I don't have, and that's guilt.
Right. That's awesome.
That's guilt. Yeah, yeah. That's the only, I really can't. I think it's some much of grief is built on guilt, and I don't have any guilt the way I handle it because I would do it differently. Yes.
But that's my question. Not about the guilt, but like,
what would I do differently?
Yeah. And obviously you did the best you could at the time. We're just looking at it from the perspective of, you know, people who are listening, who are in the midst of it. What would you have done differently?
Sure. People call me about that. When I evaluate, I tell my parent, I'm not an addictionologist. I'm a parent who's experienced 2 losses, and they happen to be one of the stories. Things is interesting about stories is that they took 2 different paths to the same ending.
Yeah, yeah. And
2 very distinct paths. But when I talk to someone who has the, again, I was I think I've told you, maybe I told this to someone before today. I was talking to someone this morning. The behavior and the characteristics of someone who is being controlled by alcohol and drugs, even though it's unique to your family, is very similar from one child to the next. It's really kind of amazing. So, but with that said, when I talk to parents who definitely have this issue going on, you know, they check all the boxes, in my opinion. I say, you know, I was, and they're 14 years old. They've barely gotten through adolescence. And, you know, drugs and alcohol, I don't know how young you were. But for Christopher, when he died at 21, he might as well have been 16 maturity-wise. It robs you of your adolescence, and it certainly did for him. So when I see a person like that, classic, I say, look, I fought this. And when people kind of knew what I was going through, and I went through one rehab and then another rehab, they finally said to me, look, Steve, you need to send Christopher away to be rewired. He needs to be rewired. And this is when I started really understanding this disease and how it affects your mind.
Right, brain. Right. The brain.
And I started understanding this a whole lot better because I kept when they talk about relapse, I said, well, I better start thinking about this because I didn't know about relapse. Where's the next chapter?
Right.
Okay. And there's plenty of chapters afterwards, I realized. But I recommend people, I said, look, when you know this is happening and you want to give it the best shot possible, there are places out there where, you know, 28 days is a thing really kind of developed by insurance companies.
Exactly.
And everybody patterned themselves for 28 days. Well, 28 days is nothing.
It's crap.
You know, 28 days ain't going to get you anywhere.
Nope.
Okay.
It'll detox you.
Detox and stabilize,
but that's about it.
Yeah. It ain't going to start changing your behavior yet or anything.
Or your brain chemistry.
No. So, and I said 60 days doesn't do it. 90 days doesn't do it. You know, maybe an adult, but even with an adult, it's hard. You know, they say adults go 7 times in their lives before they truly are sober, if that's their intent. An adolescent, you know, I think they say age of first use is a great indicator of lifelong sobriety or lifelong illness. Okay? So age of first use is a big deal. So I always tell people, look, try to find a program, whether it's this wilderness program, whether it's one that I helped start in Asheville, North Carolina, which is more like a boarding school setting. A lot of it's based on budget, obviously.
What's that called?
It's called Montford Hall. I helped start that. It's been open for about 6 years. It's basically a boarding school. This person who started it is a PhD and is in recovery himself, and of course, like many of them are, that have these ventures. And he wanted to start a not-for-profit wilderness program in an urban setting because it doesn't happen. Where he firmly believed that after a period of time, we've got to put this toe back in the water, you know, and test the water. Not bad tests, but, you know, test the water in a city because some of these places are out in the middle of nowhere.
you know, and they come back after 9 months in the middle of nowhere to Los Angeles or to New York City or to Charlotte, North Carolina, Atlanta, Georgia, and boom, you know, how many of these people have ever heard about that all of a sudden the day after or 1 week after, you know, they've either died of a drug overdose, one, or they're back, you know, and it didn't work. So I always tell folks we need to try something that is at least 6 to 8 months long to just get to it. And at a minimum, I said, you know, I said 90 days. I was pigged on 90 days because no one really educated me on it until I finally realized someone said, you got to send away for 18 months. And I'll never forget. I got Christopher there. Said, look, Chris, this ain't working. Mississippi didn't work. Knoxville didn't work. Greenville's little program didn't work. I'm taking you to Houston, Texas, and we're going to go to a wilderness program outside of Houston, Texas, in a little town. There's a girl here in town who's there, and she today is very sober, and that was great for her. And it's going to cost this much a month. I didn't know where I was going to get it. You know, I had no idea. It's going to cost $8,000 or $9,000 a month. And that's where I was. I was trying to, what am I going to do? So we got in this plane, and we went down to Houston, Texas. He was willing, you know. We rented a car. We drove out to this place, middle of nowhere. And I dropped them off. I talked to a few people. But there were these four or five guys there that were in the program, Christopher's age, that looked like bouncers. They were so big. Okay. And I thought, I could tell that they were in on the conversation, that they were there for a reason. And the reason was, if Christopher decides to go, they ain't going to let him. Right? And I think Christopher knew that too. Christopher was very savvy. I think Christopher knew it too. So I write a check for $8,000 or $9,000. I can't remember. I knew I couldn't cover it. And I knew I couldn't figure out how to cover it. Okay. I didn't know how. Okay. And that was the next problem. But I give it to her. And I leave. I go down this dirt road, which was like 2 miles. I get out and I get a little bit lost going back to my hotel in Houston. And sure enough, I get there and Christopher's there. He had run down this two-mile road, right?
Yeah.
He left his bags there. Okay. He'd run down this 2 mile road. He hitchhiked downtown Houston and got to the hotel right before I did. And I said, because he stayed there the night before, so he knew where it was. So I said, okay, Chris, what's up? He said, I'm not staying there, Dad. Those people are nuts. I said, well, it's just a rehab like any other one that you've been to. He said, no, it's different. They're a little crazy over there. You know, the school thing and the whole nine yards, I know it's important, but I'm not staying there. 18 months, maybe? Are you crazy? So I said, well, here, Chris. I gave him $20. I said, look, you can buy drugs or you can buy dinner, okay? But you're not staying here tonight. It's the first time I ever did this. And I remember it was horrible. I got in that room. I cried the whole night. I don't know where he went. He stayed in Houston for about 6 months, and he finally met a family member, distant family member, and lived with them and caused chaos because their son was in the same deal, right? So that's when I left Christopher on the street in Houston, and that was my attempt at this long-term program. So long answer to a short question, I would try to find a program that's affordable, believable, has a good reputation, and have it for as long a period of time as possible. It's very hard to tell yourself as a parent that your little darling is going away for 18 months. You know, that's very hard for a parent. And I think I struggled with that certainly in the beginning when people started telling me about these things.
Right. But from your perspective, having the background that you have, you know, probably in retrospect,
I'd do it in a heartbeat because one, they're going to be of an age, that age. Christopher had already turned 18,
so
he can run. He could go. That was the risk, and I knew the risk. You take a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old, they're kicking and screaming. They're going to stay. They have to stay. So that was sort of the difference, and that was why I would encourage someone, and it's very important when we start talking about kids, and I said, well, how old is your son? Oh, he's 17 and a half. I said, ooh, well, now's the time we got to think about this.
Yeah.
Because the alternatives are much better. You don't want your 17-year-old, who's really a 14-year-old in his head, mature-wise, going in an environment with adults, because adults have bigger problems, different problems entirely than adolescents do.
Right.
So all of a sudden, Christopher found himself in these communities with these gentlemen, okay, older gentlemen, doctors, lawyers, different parts of the community. He went to a very nice place in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and he went there twice. And they were good, but nothing you know, Christopher was one of those, you know, you hate to say that. I know we gave it a best shot, but you hate to say it wasn't going to work, but he's as close to the one that it wasn't going to work for.
Yeah.
Stay tuned to hear more in just a moment. Hi, it's Ashley, your host. I'm so excited to announce a brand new support group at Lion Rock called Community. Community is a recovery support group where all people in the pursuit of peace in mind and body may find hope and healing through connections with each other. Community is open to everyone and meetings are available online daily, Monday through Saturday. For more information, please visit our website, www.lionrockrecovery.com, and click on Meetings tab. Come and join us. So, okay, let me just tell you a little bit about Community. Community is awesome, in part because I helped write it. But so I just want to tell you a little bit about the belief. So this is a place where people can come. Doesn't matter what you're recovering from. Doesn't matter how you define your recovery, your sobriety, your abstinence, what have you. And I just want to give you a little snapshot. Here are the beliefs of the program. We believe that finding peace in recovery requires a personal path and that recovery looks different for different people. We celebrate the diversity of paths and traditions. We believe that our lives can be different from what they are today, and we can get there with the support of community when we ask for help. We believe that we can change our lives if we can conquer our fears by doing the work. We believe that recovery requires renewal and depends on personal growth. Like many people before us, we believe you get what you give. We give positive energy. We believe that our inner pain must be released for us to find freedom, and the pain is often a signal there's more work to do. The work may include repairing the damage we caused. Our common bond began with our desire to relieve our pain at all costs and continues with the cultivation of our healing through our connections to each other. Our common goal is the pursuit of peace in mind, body, and spirit. Yeah. So it's awesome. The people are awesome. The meetings are awesome. And I highly recommend you go and check that out. Please, again, go to www.lionrockrecovery.com, hit meetings tab, and you will see an exhaustive list of community recovery support group meetings, including ones for LGBTQ and upcoming ones for the podcast book club. Stay tuned.
Freshman, you know, he looked in the mirror and didn't see that beautiful kid that everybody saw. He saw somebody different, unfortunately. Okay. So, you know, how I go on and how, you know, I've dealt with this. First of all, I know I'm going to see my children again. I'm very confident that I know that God has a plan, and I didn't agree with the plan, but it's the plan. And so that comforts me a great deal. You know, and again, about 2 weeks after Kelly died, I had to go to a sales meeting, and the guy in the office who ran our office said, "Steve, you know, this is really not, but I really need some gray hair there." And so it was 2 or 3 weeks after Kelly died, right after Christmas, first week in January. So I go listen to these two guys that come to Greenville from St. Louis. And today, these two guys have huge podcasts. They're tremendous motivational speakers, Ben Newman and John O'Leary. And they were in Greenville. And they were talking to about 50 people in this little horseshoe. And they were, the speaker was out front and we were in there, and I did what I usually do and certainly felt like I didn't want to be there, because if they were going to talk about the financial services industry and I had already been in it for 30 years and all these other people were new, they're not going to say anything that I'm going to know. Okay. But I'm just going to do a favor for my manager and go there like he asks, you know, be a good soldier. So we get there, and sure enough, these guys, instead of talking about how to be a better salesman, they said after 3 days of this boot camp, it was 3 days, after 3 days of this boot camp, we're going to crystallize what your legacy is going to be when you leave this life.
Oh, wow.
And I went, okay, well, wait a second. You know, that's just it. We ain't talking about whole life versus term and all this kind of thing. You know, we're talking about some interesting stuff here. So I perked up, and they went around the room, okay, and they said, quickly tell us today what you think your legacy in life's going to be when you die, right? I mean, tough thing to talk to. There were 25-year-olds in there. I'm 50. at the time, probably 52. So you'd think mine might be a little more crystallized. But right now, I wasn't thinking about helping anybody, you know, and my legacy. I knew what my legacy was. The guy who lost his only two children, okay, to drug overdoses. And, you know, that I didn't care about what other people thought about me. That never bothered me like it bothers parents. That also never has bothered me. I was just worried about my helping, my best way to help my kids. But anyway, they get to me that day, and I'm sort of sitting at the top of this thing because I wanted to be furthest away from the speaker that I could be in case they called on me. And I stood up like you were supposed to do, and I said, hey, you know, I think I'm going to do everything I can to help adolescents and young adults who struggle with addiction, substance abuse, and mental health. I won several national awards for my work with the mentally ill, so I had some knowledge of mental health. And I knew that there is some connection, obviously, between mental health and drugs and alcohol most of the time. Most parents, when they talk to me, they don't know if it's mental health or if it's addiction. You know, what's really pushing this thing? And with girls, a lot of times it's more the mental health side, that seems like. And 9 out of 10, it's boys. It's the addiction side and not so much mental health. But regardless, that day, so I said that. And these speakers said, well, why would you do that, Steve? And I said, well, I've lost both my only two sons the last 5 years of accidental drug overdoses, and I lost one 3 weeks ago. So everybody kind of shut down. They goes, well, let's take a break. So they talked to me a little bit. Well, anyway, at that point, I drew sort of a line in the sand. And I think God was looking over me that day, certainly, because I had no inclination. It wasn't written down. There was nothing there. I wasn't expecting the question. But here's what rolls out of my mouth. Okay, well, if you knew me, it would be very characteristic of me. Because my sons knew it, my ex-wife knew it, my current wife, Kathy, knows it, that, you know, if you called me this tomorrow and said, Steve, I need something, I'm going to figure out how you can get it, okay? That's just the way I always have been wired. So sure enough, I said that. And so I started thinking about creating a foundation that would support, be a conduit to a lot of the arms of addiction, you know, the prevention, the aftercare, the care, the science of addiction, the education, early education, all these little pieces of it that I realize are not being supported as much. And there's a lot of people in this business, unfortunately, you know, the addiction business and the recovery business is several billion dollar a year business. And unfortunately, there's a lot of money in it. But I built a not-for-profit called Chris and Kelly's Hope with the help of the Greenville Community Foundation. Typically, you have to have some money to start a foundation. Well, I was broke, and I went to Bob Morris, who I knew sort of, and he said, look, Steve, we have nothing under our umbrella of funds that deals with drugs and alcohol and addiction, and certainly that's the topic. So let's go ahead and start this foundation. So literally, it was a time like you were talking about, like we were talking about earlier, actually, that people started dying of overdoses. Okay, and a couple of fairly upscale folks lost their sons the following year. And so we right away, Chris and Kelly's Hope Foundation got $100,000 from a high school pep thing, you know, it's called Spirit Week, where the kids go around, knock on everybody's door for 30 days and collect as much money as they can. And you're in competition with other high schools. And you give it to a charity. So whatever they collect, they give to Chris and Kelly's Hope. So right away out the chute, we get $100,000. Okay, so we're off to the races. And we've raised a little bit. I do it very part-time. We've raised south of $1 million. And we give away it all the time. So my bank account right now is $3,100. And I know there's two groups that need help. And my mantra is, I'll try to help you as much as I can, as long as you're a 501c3. And also I help things like junior achievement, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, healthy activities that these kids can do from that bewitching hour I used to call it, the 3:30 to 4 to 7 when both your parents aren't back from work yet, but you're home when all the garbage goes down. You know, let's have them do something else. So I'll support those groups too. But by and large, 99% of it has to do with drugs and alcohol. We started not helping individuals, but when I realized that there are individuals out there, especially young adults, who are destitute. You know, they've scratched all the plastic. They've ruined all their relationships with their brothers and sisters and parents. They've got no place to go get money. And they find themselves someplace in a shelter or something like that. And they say, you got to go to rehab. Well, I've realized that there's some very good not-for-profit rehabs that will take you in for a very nominal fee in the beginning. Maybe they'll put you on a work program, which I think is important. Mm-hmm. These are young adults, obviously, not children, but it might be $600. It might be $1,000. We've probably done 30 of those scholarships for those people, and they're overjoyed because they can't now. And a lot of them have made it. A lot of them haven't. One of them right now is back again, asking me, and he's back in. And I don't mind helping. I love helping, in fact. So, and I get a call like that, you know, once every couple of weeks. What I don't like have happen is it got in a local place here that doesn't have the greatest reputation. They started saying, if you need money, call Steve Grant. You know, I didn't want that to happen, certainly. But most of the time, it's vetted by somebody else that this person needs this and financially can't cut it. And so I work with the institution more than the individual to work it out that they can go there, which is very gratifying, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. And is that the thing that made it possible to move on or move forward, not on?
Well, it does help. You know, a lot of people would think that talking to people about this, doing a podcast, I've been in front of 1,000 people, I've been in front of 10 people, and tell my story, and I've done it in a lot of different places over the last 7 years. And my wife, Kathy, love her to death, but, you know, she says, Steve, this has got to be so debilitating for you. And, you know, in fact, it's invigorating for me. This is invigorating. I'm invigorated after I get off the phone with you. Okay, I'm not depressed. You know, so it invigorates me. And I think it's my general nature is that I know somebody's going to hear this, Ashley, and you and I are going to have helped that person. It may be more than one. And as long as it's one, then I'm real happy about it. I know you are too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why I do this. And, you know, it was my experience as well. I got sober at 19 and I've been clean and sober for 14 years and I put my life back together, but I was the same age as you know, I'm the same age as Kelly would have been. And I was around and I just happened, my overdose, the paramedics in the Bay Area just happened to have Narcan, but I would not be here without that. And it was accidental. I didn't mean to do it. It was the same thing. I came out of rehab. In fact, I had gotten out of rehab and I was 17. I gotten out of a lockdown rehab and I came out and was totally disoriented, smack back into my old world. And I had started drinking again because drinking's not.
You can do that. Yeah.
Well, and I was so disoriented. I needed to cope, right? I hadn't learned the skills. I wasn't committed. So I started drinking again. And as a result, and I always say this to people as an important piece, I have zero recollection of getting heroin. I don't have a recollection of getting needles. I don't have recollection of making that decision. I had absolutely no intention of using heroin again. I became so intoxicated that I made a decision under the influence that I do not remember. And what happened was I woke up after this Narcan overdose to a situation that I had created unbeknownst to myself, which, you know, is this interesting phenomenon where I say, you know, oh, I'm just going to start drinking. You know, people say, I'm just going to start drinking. I say, you don't know what you're going to do. That's the truth, is that if you're engaging in your addiction, if you take that first drink, you know, my experience is that I made decisions against my own will and I woke up to them.
Yeah. And, you know, I love hearing stories like yours because unfortunately you don't hear as many success stories. You know, I'm a baseball player, so a batting average is a great, you're a Hall of Famer if you bat 333, you know, 1-3, you get one hit every three times up. You pay a lot of money if you get one hit every four times up. But in this world, you don't hear about, you know, you might hear about 1-10 or 1-20, but it's a low number. Rehabs have a poor batting average. Success in this world has a poor batting average when it comes to recovery for whatever reason. But, and there's probably several of them, but I'm always stunned. So that was the first time you went to rehab, right?
No.
I mean, no. With heroin overdose, you didn't go to rehab.
No, I had gone to outpatient. I had gone to three places before the overdose, and then I went to three more.
after the overdose, and you still using heroin afterwards?
Yeah. I had the overdose, and then I went to a year-long program for young adults, which was amazing. Changed my life. All my best friends are from there. You know, it was my high school experience, basically. I lived there for a year, but I relapsed while I was there. I ran away and drank. I was 17, and then I went to another rehab, and then I went to another halfway house, and then I used again, and I infected all the veins in both of my arms. And, you know, the thing that was crazy about that is, if you had, you know, like your sons, I was not the portrait of what the heroin addict, what people think a heroin addict looks like or sounds like. And I had all the knowledge. I had been to treatment a million times. The truth was that I had to do a lot of deep work, and I had to be ready. I had to be ready to let go of this thing. And in order to stay, you know, we talk about like the 1 in 10, the 1 in 20, you know, in order to stay sober a long time, I talk about this a lot. I know when I talk to people who have been sober 10, 20 years, I know what it takes to stay sober that long. I know what it takes to be in horrific emotional pain and have no easy, you know, way to anesthetize that. Every feeling, you know, there's nowhere to go. And over time, if you are going to stay sober a long time, there's a lot of emotional, spiritual work to be done and growth to be done. And not everybody either knows how to do it or is willing to do it. And I think that's been, you know, I have been challenged over the course of my sobriety to grow up and to get better and to make my recovery stronger and to continue to keep it at the forefront. Even though I'm nothing like the person I was, I still have to be as active today in my recovery as if that person is right behind me, which is a very strange feeling.
Oh, you know that the person's behind you. And you know, I have the utmost respect for anyone that's been in recovery any length of time, especially when you see these people that know the date, and it was 30 years ago today. You know, those guys, I just get thrilled with that. And I'm in a position here that part of my role is I hire people and I mentor people. And, you know, I actually have hired a couple of guys who are in recovery, and they've been in recovery 2, 3, 4 years, because when I see on the resume that someone's an Eagle Scout, I think, well, that's pretty good, because I know it's hard to become an Eagle Scout. Okay. Well, I also know that when you share with me that you've been in recovery for 5 years or 10 years, I'll also say to my mind, I'm going, that's impressive. That's a great characteristic to have. Because I have to worry about myself at times. And I'm very envious of folks who can do that, because there's a tremendous, obviously, it's a tremendous difficulty to it. And I'm always cautious when people are announcing those anniversaries, and I say congratulations, and I say stay strong. And the reason I say stay strong is because of what you just said. You don't have to tell anybody that you know that's been in recovery for any length of time that they worry about that person behind them.
And, you know, when I got sober January 7th, 2006, and when I got sober, I was 19 years old and I had nothing. I didn't have children. I didn't have a husband. I didn't have a career. I didn't have education. I didn't have anything. And so what's terrifying is that sobriety and recovery have allowed me to build a life, right? And have allowed me to put this stuff together. And now I have so much to lose, so much. I have people who count on me, but the girl who wants to go get loaded in the back alley, the girl who wants to, she's still there and she still talks to me and she's still, you know, she's still present in the picture. And now there are stakes. And I never had stakes before. And that's a really different and challenging piece of my recovery today, which is I don't get to entertain thoughts, maybe the way that I used to kind of play with fire or what if or whatever. There are people's lives who count on me and me staying sober. And that has to be just as important too. And that's new to my recovery.
You know, you're right about the stakes. Occasionally, when my wife and I go out, you know, I'm the guy in this town, like I tell people, that he's lost two kids. But now the guy who's lost two kids but started this foundation and that park on that fitness trail that 2,600 people see every day at Chris and Kelly's Hope Fitness Park was started by this guy. You know, he's also built this, he's built that, he's helped support here, and he's helped support there. He's raised $800,000, you know, and helped people. He talks around the country. Well, my wife says, when we go out, we say, who's going to drive? You know, because one of us is probably going to drink, right? We drink socially. And always, my wife is always, and it goes through my mind, but she likes to remind me. She said, Steve, the worst thing that could happen to you right now is that if you got arrested for drinking, or you got arrested for public intoxication, or something like that. And not that that's going to happen, but there is, I do think about the stakes that I've built. That are built around me that have to, that people see me as. You know, in one of the places in my book, there was a time, obviously, I admitted that that I went to rehab for a couple of weeks after Christopher had died, a year or so after he died, and I started using a lot of alcohol. And I checked myself in for a couple of weeks, and they put me on the psychiatric side right away because they said, you're just medicating yourself, Steve, with alcohol. So, after that, but there's another thing I did that I talked about. On the anniversary of my first son's death in October of, so he died in October of 2006. On the anniversary of his death, my buddy of mine said, Steve, let's go out to have a drink. You know, he knew it was the anniversary of Christopher's death. So we went out and had a couple of beers, and we had three or four beers, but I was a mile away from my house, right? So I go home, and I was single. And at the time, I would usually get on my leather sofa, watch TV, and all of a sudden, I'll be sleeping, okay? And it's a Friday night, so I get home. It was not late. I didn't fall asleep. All of a sudden, I said to myself, you know, I think I'm going to drive downtown and get some work done in my office 10 miles away, okay? And I think I'm fine. You know where this is going, right? So I get pulled over, you know? And I ended up, you know, and it's so funny. I get in the back of the police car. They're going to take me down to the police station. I feel like dog dirt, you know, sitting there going, oh, my God. You know, here you are. And I hadn't started the foundation or anything like that yet. Kelly was still alive. Kelly saw my picture in one of those things they put in a grocery store. Because mugshot, you know, that they put in the grocery store. You know, one of his, I didn't know they did that. And one of his friends, gave it to her son, said, that looks like Steve Grant in that picture, you know? And sure enough, my son said, and I had already told him that when he came home from school one time that this is what happened. But he said, yeah, I did know it, Dad, because someone showed me the picture of you, you know, and I explained to him what happened. But what's real interesting, when I get in the car and he's driving me downtown. I had gone through all the gyrations and, you know, touch the nose and walk this and that, do that. And it was freezing out. So part of what I was really having problems with, I was shaking also. Okay. And so not making any excuse, I go down there and I'm in the car and I'm thinking, okay, what was Christopher's advice? He used to always say, Dad, if that ever happens to you, don't blow into that thing. Don't blow into it. Or did he say, if that happens to you, Dad, blow into it? I couldn't remember which one he said. So I'm going, okay. Well, the guy said, well, you know, if you don't blow into it, you're going to lose your license. Automatically, you're going to be considered guilty. You're going to lose your license for 3 months. Oh, I'm a salesman. I can't lose my license. Right? So I blew into it. And I blew it right over. I was right over. You know, well, it doesn't matter if you're right over or if you're a lot mm-hmm. over.
Same deal.
So I spent the night in the jail on a Friday night in downtown Greenville, you know, and it was an interesting evening. And I think they keep you there purposely for a lot of reasons, but you do a lot of thinking. And I only, at this point, most of my friends had gone from their landlines to their cell phones, and you couldn't call anybody to pick you up that had a cell phone. But thankfully, I have a good memory. And I called my buddy up at 1 o'clock in the morning to come pick me up. And his wife ignored the phone a few times because it was late at night, and he answered and he came down and got me. But if I had not remembered his phone number, I would have probably got let me out earlier in the morning and I would have probably had to walk home. So it was an interesting evening. And, you know, that it was one of those lessons you learn in life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that must have been quite the experience. But I mean, having been through what you've been through, I feel like people would.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I debated whether I put that stuff in the book, but I think it really makes you understand that I too am vulnerable to that, and I too am guilty of things that I shouldn't have done that have exactly to do with this monster.
Yeah, no, I mean it isn't a moral issue. It's easy to make it that, and it's easy to see it that way, but it's not a moral failing. It really has to do. There's a lot of neurobiology involved, and that really helped me. It helped me understand how my brain works and why my brain, when I put certain substances into my body, my brain kind of does a freak out, and a different part takes over, because I was successful and capable, very so, in every other area of my life. But this one area, as long as I was doing that, I couldn't function. And I think, you know, your foundation is amazing. I was actually helping someone get into treatment yesterday, and we were talking about the cost of detox and the this, that, the other. And she said, how do normal people afford this? And I said, they don't, you know, and, you know, that was my company, Lion Rock Recovery, which does online intensive. We've been doing telehealth for 10 years. We started it because my aunt died of addiction lifelong addiction. And obviously I almost died. And we started it because we wanted there to be an option for people that integrated them into their life, kind of like what you talked about, where it was like you're out in the middle of nowhere and then you get dropped back in. You don't have that support, but also something that was affordable for people, accessible. And so what your foundation is doing, making treatment accessible to people, is so vital, because it's not going to change nothing. You know, we have a saying in recovery and program, nothing changes if nothing changes, right? And so if we, as a country, as a people, as humanity, don't step in and help each other with a problem that was, you know, frankly, somewhat created by big business, you know, it's certainly nowadays, you know, mine wasn't related to OxyContin, but, you know, nowadays very much related to prescription drugs and, you know, fueled around things that we've done in our society and how we treat mental health and all these things. You know, we can't change it if we don't change how we think about it and how we treat it. If we don't see it as a medical issue, as a chronic disease, as something that can be treated, but it needs to be treated long term. And there is no cure. It's ongoing. This is, you know, I say to people, think about it like diabetes. You can get it under control, but you have to maintain that control. You have to continue to take your medicine. You have to continue to eat well. You have to continue to upgrade your diabetic recovery as your body ages, right? As your cellular being changes. This is the same, but it doesn't go away. It's not going to go away. And that's so, I mean, I spend so much time talking to parents about it, as I know you do, which is, this is not what you think it is. And it's important that you learn what you're dealing with before you do anything else. Learn what this is, so that when these things come to you, when the fly balls come to you in baseball speak, you have enough knowledge to be able to make a quick decision. Because I think so often it's just going on blind faith or what you think you know.
You're absolutely right. And I'm sitting here thinking a little bit more about me, and maybe you brought up a good topic about getting as much knowledge as you can about the issue. I ran into James Dobson several months ago, you know, the famous James Dobson. And we were on our way to church, and Kathy said, there's going to be some guy here, like, called Focus on the Family. Oh, I said, oh, no, James Dobson's not going to be here, Kathy. Kathy had no kids, but no really knew who James Dobson was. James Dobson is not going to be at your church, Kathy.
There's no way he's going to be here. Well, sure enough, there he is. And I said, well, Kathy, this is like Billy Graham had just died, actually. And I said, this is like Billy Graham almost. He's in the top 10, James Dobson, right? So I'm listening to him, and I've read some of his books. And I went up to him afterwards, and I said, hey, I'm Steve Grant. He said, hey, thank you. Nice to be here. You know, great. Da, da, da. And I said, hey, you know, I don't want to cut to the chase, but I lost two kids to drug overdoses, accidental drug overdoses. And here's my card. I have a card that has pictures of my boys. It says Chris and Kelly's Hope on it. And I handed it to him. And I said, he said, oh, God bless you. This is horrible. It's a terrible problem around the country here. And I said, you know, I had the pleasure of reading all your books, basically. And he said, which ones? And I said, no, I can't remember the titles of them, but I do know one thing. I read them too late. And he kind of went, wow. And I said, yeah. I said, at least I understand that. And a lot of what you're talking about is I read things too late, or I understood too late. I understood why Christopher needed to be in a place for 18 months when I tried three places in 30 days or three places in 90 days. I understand that now. And hopefully that can be the benefit. So, you know, when I wrote this book, you know, a lot of people were shocked that, hey, your son died 15 years ago. The other one died 10 years ago. You know, why are you writing a book now, right? Well, you know, it's just, it was always something and always something. Everybody kept saying, you got to write a book. No one's lost their only two children, although I've found a few people who have. And then maybe they haven't, like Christopher Kelly, taken two distinct roads to the same outcome. So what I realized when I was writing this book was, I needed to tell people the why. Why does this happen? And that book is less for people who are going through. Some people think it's help people with grief. Well, I don't know anything about grief, really. Okay? And I don't mean it doesn't exist. It certainly does exist. It ruined my mother's life for the rest of her life that she lost her daughter. Okay? It really did. It consumed her the rest of her life in one way or another. Okay? I'm not consumed by my kid's death only through this channel. You know, there are times I go to a deep, dark spot. I'll see something on television. Actually, I drive every day to a location that Christopher flipped the car in, and I found him who walked away from it after flipping a car. And I drive past that spot every day, and I think about it, but I don't let it ruin my day. So I'm trying to immerse myself in something else. But when I was writing this book, I had to tell people, well, why is it that Christopher thought there was a pill for every problem? You know, maybe it was because he started using Ritalin at 5 years old because he was an active child, and the teacher said, you know, I think your son needs to have some Ritalin. And I remember as a parent saying, oh my God, he's already, and then at the end of the year, well, I think he ought to repeat. You know, so okay, we'll repeat, you know, and we go through this in my book, and then next it's Adderall, then it's whatever, and then, you know, he gets an injury, he starts knowing about Oxycontin, Lortabs, he goes to my doctor, who's a good buddy of mine, a client, and, you know, he went one day after scoring three goals in a soccer game, and the next morning he said, oh, my knee's killing me, Dad. This was another one of these indicators, and the doctor knew it. Because he was in there shopping a big opioid, you know. He thought he was coming. So he comes out of the car and he sits down next to me and he says, and I could tell he was obsessed. What's the matter? He said, he gave me Mobic. Mobic. I said, what is Mobic? He said, Mobic's like candy, Dad. You know, and I'm sitting there going, shoot, I got a pharmacist on my hands.
Yep.
And the doctor knew it. The doctor knew what he wanted. And he gave him Mobic, but Christopher knew that Mobic was like, you know, I can't sell Mobic to my friends. Right.
Right. So, yeah. It's
so the book goes into all those things, and it's really of more interest really to someone like you, not so much because you've been through it. It's probably interesting for you just to read it yourself. And I always caution people that if they're in recovery, it's clearly in the front of the book. If you're in recovery, this may be a difficult read. If you lost your children, or any child, that might be a difficult read. But for that parent that is very concerned about their 7, 8, 10-year-old kids, you know, who are going out in the world, you know, and maybe, you know, like I used to tell my kids when they're growing up, because of my family and my ex-wife's family having some alcohol issues, significant alcohol issues, I say, you know, guys, you're going to like something one day. I guarantee you, one of these days, you're going to like something. You know, and might be bad, but you're going to like. Okay. And I used to say that, not all the time. I just say, you're going to like something. Well, Kelly found heroin. Boom. You know, he liked it. Christopher found marijuana eventually. Boom, he loved it.
But that's the thing about, and I want to touch on this, which is that's the thing about marijuana. Like, the substance is a symptom of the problem. And so I think a lot of times people focus on what the substance is. Oh, it's marijuana and alcohol. Oh, it's this. And I think what's important is if your child or person you love, whatever, is seeking to feel differently than they feel using substances, it doesn't matter what that substance is.
It could be video games today.
It could be
video games on your cell phone, video games on your iPad. It could be anything. It could have been me shooting basketball free throws for 2 hours every night growing up. You know?
Right.
I mean, it was something that, you know, it was my behavior.
Right. It's about the escape. And I think that's the part that confuses or you know, kind of hides this issue, is where people say, well, he's just doing X, Y, Z. And I say, look, it doesn't matter what the substance is. They'll change substances that, you know, they'll switch. It may not be their drug of choice and they'll use it. Or when people say, you know, kind of like your son did and I did, which is, oh, I'm going to stop the alcohol, but I'm going to continue with the marijuana. Or whatever. It's like, it's not about the substance. I mean, that you put heroin isn't evil. You put it on a desk and it doesn't do anything. It's not going to hurt anybody. It's not going to, you know, it's not the substance. It's about what happens what it's doing for that person. And I just think it's so important that we're talking about, look, we have a mental health crisis on our hands. And the reason that I did a press tour recently, and there was they did an opener about me, and they're like, childhood drinker, Ashley. And I started laughing. I was like, childhood drinker. But I realized I was a childhood drinker. I was a little kid. And why was that? Because I didn't have the skills to deal with the feelings, the emotions, what was going on in my life. I didn't know how to do that. And these things solved that problem for me. And
you found something you liked.
Found something
I liked. Made you feel good.
Yep. So anyway, I am just so grateful to you for being here and telling your story. It's amazing. And I want to direct everybody to your foundation site and help with that cause, because I think that you're doing amazing work and I want as many people to know about it. What's the name of your book?
The book is called Don't Forget Me. And real quickly, the publisher had a great idea. He got a picture from me with Christopher before 2005, took a selfie of his hand reaching up into the sky. I don't know why he took it. I kept it. It was a color picture of just his left hand reaching up in the sky. So they took that picture and they made it the cover of the book. And for some significance, there's some clouds in the picture. So he's reaching up to the clouds. And then Don't Forget Me came from a picture that my mother found after both my sons had died. We were going through some pictures. And she said, have you seen this picture, Steve? I said, yeah, that's a picture of Christopher playing soccer in the ninth grade. You know that, Mom. And she said, no, have you read the back of it? And I said, no, what's on the back of it? She said, it said Christopher's handwriting, Don't Forget Me. You know, and my mom said, well, what is that? I said, well, I think that's a God wink or God thing, because I said, I've never seen this before. Yeah, it's really eerie. So that's where Don't Forget Me came, and the picture's in the book. And his handwriting, his handwriting was not very good, and it's very obvious it was his. So I said, wow. So the book's Don't Forget Me, and it, you know, came out February 4th. We had a great article in the Wall Street Journal about us, which is, I think, where you may have found out about me. And then there was a subsequent article about me in the Wall Street Journal. Had a lot of interest from that and a lot of things like this podcast. It was also Amazon's number one bestseller for 3 weeks in the drug and alcohol category.
Okay.
So, you know, it's going to help a lot of people. But most of the proceeds of it go to the foundation. So I'm always interested in selling more. And it was sold out several times. It was nice to hear that from my friends who said, I tried to order it, but it's on order.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, so, that's amazing. And
yeah, the book world is a little, I don't know if you've written a book yet, Ashley, but the book world, I'm not writing another book. This is a one and done. And I really do mean that. And I don't think those are words I'll ever regret. But not that I hated it, but it's a long process. It's not as easy as people think.
Yeah, I have a book on Amazon that was published by my company, so I didn't have to go through the I didn't have to go through a real publisher, but I've heard that it's intense.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, it was, the reason I think the book has done well, again, is because we tell the why. We have a guy named James Campbell, who's an addictionologist, he's PhD. He happened to be in Greenville. I happened to know him through the course of contributing to different organizations. I asked him, hey, listen, can you help me write this book? And he said, I'd love to. I'd be honored to. So I would tell him a story, and he'd say, well, this is why this happens. You know, and there's a lot of pictures in it, a lot of notes. I kept everything from rehabs. I kept everything from doctor's reports, kept all the letters that I got that told me what a jerk I was. Mm-hmm. This is the best thing that ever happened to me, Dad, and all those. Mm-hmm. So it kind of lets people know that they're not alone in this battle. This is a behavior that their son or daughter had, too.
Yeah.
Or this could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for writing that and giving that. I know it means a lot to people out there to share that. And it's an extraordinary and from wonderful to terrible on every spectrum story. What, tell us where people can find the foundation.
The foundation is www.chriskellyhope.org. And on that is, you know, I have a great, Stacy Devil does a great job keeping up with all the things that I do. And eventually when this goes public, we'll post this on our website, hopefully. And there's a lot of things on it. And then we have a separate website for the book, of course. And, we get a lot of interesting things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful. Well, thank you so very much for being here and for doing this and sharing your story with me and your time. I really appreciate it. And I love what you're doing and will definitely be an active supporter.
Well, I appreciate it too. And I most enjoy meeting people like you.
Thank you.
It's a great thing you're doing. And congratulations on your own sobriety.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And your husband's too. And God bless you.
Thank you. Thank you. You as well.
Take care. Thanks, okay. Ashley.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye now.
Bye.
This podcast is sponsored by Lion Rock Recovery. Lion Rock provides online substance abuse counseling where clients can get help from the privacy of their own home. They are accredited by the Joint Commission and sessions are private, affordable, and user-friendly. Call their free helpline at 800-258-6550 or visit www.lionrockrecovery.com for more information.